All right, thank you, everybody. Welcome back here. We're going to vote to start our question period with Simon Dyer. Again, this is the first meeting of SACPA on campus. We're discussing environmental issues in the oil sands. I'll just remind you how this is going to work. If anybody wants to ask a question, just come up to this microphone here, introduce yourself to the camera, and ask your question. Limit yourself to one question, and don't speak for any more than a minute, because I will cut you off. So, I'm serious. Who wants to go first?
Great to see you all in this geography. So I haven't out forth. I might take 70 minutes. So, but I'll try. The National Energy Policy. My name is Anthony Hall, and I am founding coordinator of the Mobilization Studies. And I want to speak about jurisdictional issues and the concept that this resource, I believe, has implications for all of Canada, that we should embrace our Canadian sovereignty and express our Canadian sovereignty through the intelligent use of this resource for our own national purposes, not only provincial purposes. I don't think the claim of the provincial government that they have exclusive jurisdiction in that resource is as true. If you actually go into the BNA Act, the relevant sections. And basically what offends me is this resource is being used to prop up, to feed the military-industrial complex of the United States in a time when it is acting in a very aggressive and illegal, lawless, ruthless fashion, torture camps, dark sites. This resource is being used to fund and to energize and to supply the most... the most really imperialistic, ruthless empire that, and it's not just me saying this. Okay, the question is, do you believe that Alberta controls all of the jurisdiction in the oil sands?
That's a good question. Alberta does not control the total jurisdiction here, and in many ways the federal government has been pretty passive in not enforcing its jurisdiction. There are major transboundary issues, there are major water issues and pollution issues. Now you're starting to see acidification in Saskatchewan and Manitoba and issues downstream. So clearly Alberta does consider itself to be in the driving seat in terms of how to develop this. Certainly, your comment about American demand is a fair one, although it's important to note that, other countries in the world are desperately trying to get in on the action. We have Chinese state oil companies now involved in the oil sands, and there's talk about pipelines across BC to get this offshore to the Pacific. So certainly there's a battle going on to see who is going to get Alberta and Canada's oil here. And I think there does need to be a much broader discussion on what is the most appropriate rate and the most appropriate use for oil from the oil sands. And so I think you raised some good points there.
All right, we'll have the next question. I'll just remind you again, keep it to a minute. And if you go over a minute, I'm going to shut the mic off. We have a lot of questions to get through. So who would like to go next?
I don't have a statement to make, so it'll be under 60. Hi, Alan Gibson is my name. I'm trying to get a sense on this bottom line equivalency so that I can make up my own mind about energy use, the oil sands, whether they make sense or whether they don't make sense. So your figures were a barrel of oil, the energy to upgrade a barrel of oil from the oil sands currently would be the equivalent of heating a home with natural gas for 1.5 homes for a day, correct? How much oil would it take to heat 1.5 homes out of a barrel of oil?
There is research hasn't been done. I think what you're trying to get at is the total net energy balance, total input. I think clearly the total energy balance out from a barrel of oil sands is less than the natural gas that went into it in terms of kilojoules. I think the point I was trying to make is we're using a very clean burning source of oil to create dirty oil. So no one has, I'm not aware of a good publicly available source that has sort of taken that apart in detail and said what is the energy balance. I've seen numbers bandied around that it's somewhere like 3 for 1. So for each 1 unit of energy you put in terms of natural gas, you get 3 units out in bitumen, which is conventional energy is in the realm of 10 to 1. So it's obviously more intensive, but I mean we're not talking about a net negative energy balance, but we are talking about use of a very clean burning source of energy for a use, basically producing globule. Good question.
Tim Burton from University of Oregon. Simon, thanks for being here. Just a quick preamble. Your story is very much like our story, and we've reviewed about 12 of these ideas independently, and we come up with very similar discussions. And actually, your last point as well, that's what we came up with. About 20% of the energy gets to have to put in to get back out. Well, 30%, 35% is decided to use. My question, since I agree with everything you said, I'm going to talk about something you didn't get at, and I wonder, because we were both at the Sun Coal hearing in 2006, there's been a number of Nixon Creek pass away due to cancer rates, which are much higher, hundreds of thousands of times higher than typical rates. Have you heard anything about the health study, which is supposed to look at health of First Nations in Maine and Alberta because of the health sense?
It's something that Pembina hasn't done work on, and it's a highly emotional issue, and a major issue, and I think it's finally, I think it might be the trigger to actually get the level of diligence we actually need to get these issues looked at. I know the local medical examiner has raised concerns, and there were concerns raised that 15 years ago, I believe, that as a result of the Northern Basin River Studies, it was requested that the Alberta government did the detailed epidemiological analysis to see what was going on. That work wasn't done, as far as I can see, so it's another example of the monitoring and the management lacking behind the expansions here. So I'm probably in a similar position to you in terms of, we've heard rumors, and I certainly know people in Fort Chippewyan who believe very strongly that something is wrong, but Pembina doesn't have any information on that. We don't have expertise in the health realm, so I can't really answer that. Yeah, no, I haven't seen it.
I'm Paul Hinman, elected representative for Carson Table Warner. We've had an excellent tax regime for developing tar sands. I'll go back because that's what we work. How do you feel about a tax regime now, though, that would be environmentally friendly, that if one of those companies wanted to spend $5 billion on CO2 sequestration or new technology, toe-to-heel development, how do you feel about changing that regime so it's new development, this new technology that is environmentally friendly, so we actually spin it forward and get out of the old technology and into something new?
Great question, Paul. The old royalty regime has done its job, which is to stimulate development in the oil sands. It's important to note, though, that we have a completely different context to when that regime was brought in place. At the time, oil was $20 a barrel, and companies were just still figuring out how to extract this oil economically. Now these companies are highly profitable, and oil is $60 a barrel. So there's a real need to re-look at that royalty regime. And so just in terms of simple dollars, I think that Alberta could extract significantly more for Albertans without having any impact in terms of scaring off capital. Your question about economic incentives and using royalty incentives to create those sort of issues, certainly that's something we haven't done a lot of work to map out in detail, but Pembina is flexible in terms of the approaches we support, and those sort of incentive instruments is something we'd look at. Certainly we need to, if we are going to do carbon capture and storage, which would be a way to deal with, the greenhouse gas problem, it is going to need a significant amount of funds. However, I think we still believe strongly in the polluter pays principle, and we don't think companies should get royalty holidays to do what we think they should be required to do anyway. But I think we could use incentive tools to push them further.
Professor Page. Simon, thanks for a great presentation. Has Pembina put the reports you presented today and the other ones that you have up on one of your slides to the federal government and to the provincial government? And if so, what are the reactions of both of those two bodies?
Yes and yes. We've presented at federal environment committees, and our oil sands fever reports, and all our reports have a mailing list, and we deliver these for city ministers and the majority of elected representatives. We have not had a strong response, or we've offered to engage with the government, but we've been limited opportunities. We participate in the oil sands consultation process, which is now a government-led process, and we have one environment, we're one of the few environmental organizations that sits on that group with industry and First Nations. Our concern is that this consulting has taken place while projects still be approved, so we're sort of operating both where we can on the inside, but also calling for a moratorium. So we meet with bureaucrats and elected officials regularly, but there does not appear to be a sense of urgency there or that these issues are large enough to deal with. So I just go back to the comment that it has been said they're not hearing this issue from their constituents. So. I'm not a climate scientist, but I know there's a lot of work that is being done on recognizing, we already have global warming. The question now is just how bad it's actually going to get. So I think there still is an opportunity for us to reduce emissions and stabilize the climate, and then start to look at turning that around. I think the issues I talked about in terms of carbon capture and storage, it's not a silver bullet, but it's one sort of quiver in the arrow of options that we need to deal with global climate change. And although per capita Canada is a huge greenhouse gas polluter, and the oil sands are one of those significant causes, but I mean, this obviously is a truly global issue. Canada is only responsible for 2% of global emissions, which is, I mean, doesn't get rid of the need for us to do our share, but there's obviously going to be a bunch of major global solutions.
Thank you, Simon. Wonderful presentation. My name is James Wood. I have a question. Article 605 of the NAFTA agreement is a proportionality clause requiring us to send the same amount of total Canadian supply to the United States, or amounts about 70%. With conventional resources declining and oil sands increasing, what sort of pressures do you see the United States putting that we have to continue producing from the oil sands and increasing production to feed them under that clause? And supplementary question, is the correct alternative there to give them 6 months and stop that agreement? Some of the implications from that.
There's some broad questions here. I'm not a climate scientist. I'm not a trade lawyer either. But also, the proportionality clause, I mean, gives me cause for concern as well. I mean, it does appear that the way it is worded, that there is an expectation that we will, continue to meet that that oil demand. And I think there should be a discussion about whether that is in the long-term best interest of Canadians, because that the whole issue also concerning, I think, if you want to talk about maximizing benefits for Albertans, the whole issue about bitumen and whether that bitumen should be upgraded here in the province or whether that should be shipped south as well. So these are major issues that I think people are just starting to awaken to and they realize what we've got ourselves into here.
Yeah, my question is with regards to energy intensity. As your presentation shows, it's a very energy intense process. And you also suggested that nuclear wasn't an option for using nuclear again, So in the intervening period between transitioning from an oil-based economy to a sustainable economy, or a more sustainable economy, what is really the best way in terms of still getting the oil out, or still getting the bitumen out in terms of energy intensity? Or is it just reducing consumption of bitumen, or what really is the issue around energy?
Yeah, the question was recognizing that bitumen extraction is a very energy-intensive process. What is the best way to deal with that challenge? Is it better just to reduce expansion of bitumen use, or are there other ways we can do that? Mentioning I sort of slammed nuclear in my presentation. I think there are, I think long term, I don't think we want to see an Alberta where we extract every one of those 175 billion barrels of oil from the oil sands. I think the environmental impacts would be staggering. On the Alberta government website, they boast about the fact we've only extracted 3% of our 97% more to go. So that's a challenge. In terms of, so I think we want to transition from oil sands before we use that up. If we recognize we need to use some sort of energy source in the interim, and natural gas is not that and nuclear is not that, I think there are two options. The first option, which is a sort of short-term fix, would be something called gasification. This is where you can, a waste product of the upgrading process is coke, basically, coal and that. That could be burned to produce energy, which in itself produces vast amounts of greenhouse gases as well. But tied to carbon capture and storage, that could be a cheap and effective energy source. A better long-term solution, something that could actually help the oil sands companies actually contribute something perhaps to a long-term energy supply, sustainable supply solutions for the world, is something to deep geothermal. This discussion about it, it's actually gone beyond discussions, but if you could drill down 12 kilometers, you could get as much heat as you wanted to provide the energy to power the oil sands. And that could be a technology that could export and could become the basis of a new sustainable energy source. So those are the things that are on the horizon.
I'm sorry, my name is Mark Sandinez. I really appreciated your presentation and the work that the Canada Institute does.
I do have a question about carbon capture and storage, which you agreed to meet on the slides at CCS. Mm-hmm. Tim Flannery, in his book, The Weathermakers, doesn't speak very highly of carbon capture and storage, partly because of the energy required to get the carbon in a form so you can store it, and secondly, the limited amount of space there is to store carbon dioxide in whatever form. Now, he's talking more about Australia than Canada. Do you have any comments about that, those problems?
Yeah, those there is, as I think I mentioned, there's going to be no silver bullet solution and nothing that works everywhere. Pembina, on our website, we actually have a research report assessing the pros and cons of carbon capture and storage. Two reasons why it actually has high potential here in Alberta. One is that we're talking about a very concentrated point source of CO2 coming out of these upgraders and these oil sands plants. So that deals with some of the economics. It obviously doesn't work in places where you're trying to capture a much more dispersed source. And from my understanding of the geology, is that we are actually pretty lucky here in Alberta in terms of the Western Sedimentary Basin that we have some of the best potential geology for this to actually work. So there's enough research being done on this by companies and increasingly by government that I think this could go, but it's going to need a strong regulatory system to force companies to invest in this and make it happen. So I agree, it doesn't, it's still the pollution equivalent to sort of, trying to hide the garbage somewhere. I think we should, look at a whole host of issues to deal with the problem, but as one of the potential solutions, I think it, especially considering the pressing issues we have in Fort Canada, it's worth it.
All right, well, if there are no more questions, I guess we'll bring this session to a close. I'd like to thank Simon again for coming down all this way to give this presentation, a very contemporary issue, one that's going to be affecting every single one of us at this table for generations, so it's definitely something that needs to be discussed more. I'll just remind you once again that this Thursday, SACPAW is hosting another one of their regular sessions, Thursday at noon at Sven Eriksson's. Kevin Taft, the provincial Liberal leader, pardon me, will be giving... Sorry, I'm projecting, sorry. he'll be giving a discussion on political issues in Alberta today, and I'm sure he'll be discussing oil sands because you can't talk about politics in Alberta without talking about oil sands.
Ladies and gentlemen, when something of immense consequence happens, it's important just to make a statement to note it in passing. This is a historical event. It is the first time in history, 40-year history of the Council of Public Affairs, I was there at the beginning, to see a joint meeting of faculty and students and community discussing an object issue of fundamental concern, the future of society. This has happened today, and it has happened not because of an oldster, a rivalry years like me and others who attend the Council of Public Affairs. It has been the students themselves who have given the initiative and the leadership and the vision to make this possible. There's people like Cody here, who's president of the Political Science Club, and when we thought about an original planning meeting about asking Cody to chair it, I said, Cody, it can sometimes get sharp. Have you a sharper edge? To which Cody immediately replied, I can do that. Remember? He said it. John Oxley is over there. John Oxley is manager of the student union. A person of rare judgment and competence and ability to get things done. He helped facilitate. Sheila is over there. She is another worker in a collection of people who happen to have the vision and the energy to make it happen. This is the right building. It's the right place. It's the right size of room. The parking lot has been made available. It's open to students and to faculty and to community. Judging across the mirror is a hard thing to do. All of this has been accomplished in this meeting. It's a historic meeting.